Now, I'm with Bob Gove, and it is April 24th, and we got on the subject of hemorrhoids.
Are we going?
We are going.
We are going. We are going. Well, I was talking. I guess I need to start out to say that one of the things that baffles me is that I'm such a talker, because you see, the Indians were not, didn't have very much to say. They mostly acted. And my grandfather, on my mother's side, was born on an Indian reservation, and I'm not sure whether he was half Indian or, but he must have been, you know, to be born on an Indian reservation. And I know that my father's mother was an Indian lady, so you see, I have it on both sides. And
were they from around here?
Well, they were. My father's family was from Lincoln, and my mother's family was from Bristol, Vermont,
so
which over the mountain.
Probably Abnaki then.
Well, probably Abnaki, but you see, they didn't talk about that. They didn't talk about their Indian ancestry. They weren't very proud of it. It seems they didn't want to ever talk about that, and so I didn't even know that my grandfather on my mother's side was Indian, and that he was born on an Indian reservation like that, until about 2 years ago when I was talking to one of my cousins. My mother never, she always said that we were French, but it was a combination of French and Indian, that's what it was, but she just didn't want to talk about it.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
And how had your cousin heard?
My cousin, well, I'm not sure how she heard, but apparently her mother must have told her, you know, and her mother must have been proud of it or whatever, and told her. And they had the India. Oh, I was going to say that I can't understand how that I happen to be such a fluid talker, so to speak, because some of my brothers and sisters, they were, you could see the Indian traits in them. They never wanted to talk. It was a job to get them to tell you a story of any kind or things that they had been doing. They kept it to themselves, mostly. Once in a while, they would get started, perhaps, and tell you a little something, but they didn't want to talk about it. They didn't talk about themselves or what they were doing, and I can't understand why, as I say, that I am such a talker, when the rest weren't, really. The whole family was not, they weren't. Well, the Indians, what they passed down, I guess, to my father was, and mother, was this spring tonic that they used every spring. And there's bushes that grow in the wet places, like down beside brooks, and they called it tagalder. And probably there's another name for it, but that's all I ever heard it called, was tagalder. And those bushes don't get to be more than, oh, 2 or 3 inches through. And mostly they would cut one off that was an inch through. My father would visit with his jackknife and take that up to the house and scrape that bark off and put it in a dish and then put some water with it and put it on the stove to boil. And that is what they took for a spring tonic. And they took it very religiously every spring. And they, of course, they would try to have us kids take it, but didn't have very good luck. It was terrible taste and stuff, you know. And another, they did lots of things back there. Like my father, he believed that, and you couldn't tell him any different back in those days. He had hemorrhoids terribly. And spirits of turpentine was what he used. And he often said that he wished there was a whole, that he had a bathtub half full of that. He said if he had a bathtub in the house, that he would fill it half full of that spirits of turpentine and just sit in there and let it soak. But he had the hemorrhoids, and I've seen him many a time just take that bottle of of turpentine and pour his hand full, as much as he could hold of it, and then just reach around and come right up across those hemorrhoids with that. And he told me what a wonderful reaction it was. And I had hemorrhoids when I was about 16 or so, maybe 15 or something like that. And he, after a while, he talked me into doing that. And I'll tell you that I suffered. It was no curing thing for me. It was just agony. And I remember very well that my nephew, who was 4 years younger than I was, my older sister's boy and I were quite a lot like brothers, and he stayed with us a lot, and he was there. And he always loved to tell about that I started for the watering trough at the barn where the cattle and horses watered with my, and I jumped right into that tub just screaming, because I thought that cool water would, I went right in with my clothes on. they thought it was pretty funny, I guess.
I've heard of turpentine. Yeah, I think Earl Fuller talks about it.
Oh, Earl Fuller talked about turpentine, yeah. And did anyone ever tell you that if you had a cold, or if you, it didn't matter what you had, you got castor oil. Castor oil was the cure for everything. And it's pretty terrible stuff to take, and I can't imagine how I've lived all these years without it.
Did your parents used to gather herbs, or some people had in the attic of their house things hanging that they would use for medicines?
No, I don't remember that they did. I don't remember that they had things hanging in the attic like that, or that they had other herbs. But I believe I told you that this one man in Faiston, I believe that he gathered herbs all over the, and roots all over the mountains here, and made salves and different medications. And then he went out on the road peddling it on foot, because he didn't have a horse, you see. And I guess what I'd like to do this morning, and maybe there'll be one or two funny things about it, is to try to bring to you the difference in the way that people lived in those days and the way they live now. I know Warren, Vermont is a very dear place to me, because that's where I was born and brought up, and that's where I did all my hunting in my earlier years, and fishing and so forth. And as you leave Blueberry Lake and go out over the hill towards Granville, and then you go up over that other hill, I'm thinking of this place in particular right now, but there are others in the town that are the same way, that every little while when you're hunting, you come across this nice stone-laid cellar where there used to be people. There was a house there, and there was a stone foundation for the barns. And most people can't seem to realize how many of those there are and how thick they were. In other words, you aren't talking about a dairy farm. You're talking about a place where people lived that they might have had 5 acres of land. And they tried to get a living on that 5 acres of land. They had a few hens, and they raised some pigs, and they had didn't kill many beefs usually, because they killed deer. They killed deer for their meat, for their, of that kind of thing. And they just raised vegetables, and they went and they made their sugar, and they didn't buy much white sugar. They bought their salt, and they raised practically everything that they used right there on that little place. And you see, and those were hard years, and there was no place a man could go out and earn a few dollars, usually. Lots of them trapped and sold the fur that they got. cured it and sold it, and that was one way that they could get a little money on hand, was to do something like that. But most people can't realize that they hardly ever went to a store and bought anything. I remember my mother saying that she had bought a barrel of flour and and some white sugar and some salt at the store. In the fall of the year, she would always, each year, she would say this. Now, we have these commodities on hand, and if we don't get a chance, if the roads get bad or storms or whatever, and we don't get a chance to go to the store until spring, we're all right. We're all set, because we got enough things to eat. And I remember that my mother made dresses for my sisters. Of course, it wasn't so easy to make pants for the boys and whatnot. But I remember that she did make me a jacket one time, and they made jackets. But they usually bought the boys' pants at the store and shoes. But when the snow went off of the mountain in the spring and you couldn't see any more snow up there, that was the time to take off your shoes and go barefoot. And the bottom of your feet were calloused and real tough, and you could go most anywhere, especially out in the cow pasture and step in the cow manure, and it would squash up between your toes. And that was one of the things that, and I don't know. I remember my older brother. Now, he was helping to support my family, because there were eight children, and Denny was the oldest one in the family, and he had this tremendous trap line from the time he was 15 or 16 until he went to work for the Green Mountain Power Company, and he was probably 22 or 3 at that. So over a period of perhaps pretty near 10 years, he had that trap line. And he started out from Blueberry Lake and went over Fuller Hill to the, and did all of Fuller Hill. Wherever there was a good spring, he had this little hoe, and I have the hoe out here now, that he dug his springs out with to put his traps in the water to catch foxes. And so by the time that he got to Route 100, you see, he'd covered an awful lot of territory, and he would be gone all day long. He would start about daylight in the morning, and he wouldn't get back until after dark at night. And he went into Studson Hollow, across from Route 100, and then over the hill from that into the next hollow, South Hollow, and then he kept going up and down those valleys and over the next ridge until he got to Granville. Granville.
How many hollows are there on the way to Granville?
Well, there are probably 5. And you see, he went up and down those hollows. He didn't, and he was a hustler. He was a hustler, and then he went across Route 100 and came back on the mountain on the other side, as far as my sister and brother-in-law, Ralph Buzzle, lived, which is across from Blueberry Lake. Then he would come across the swamp home. And he would have to skin those animals on the way, because he couldn't possibly take the whole carcasses and carry them. And he had a big bag strapped to his bag, and I've seen him unload that bag at night when he come home, and he might have 5 foxes in there and maybe 2 or 3 coon hides and a skunk. He didn't hesitate to take skunks and skin them. And people did those kind of things because there was no other way to get money.
Now, did he make all his own sense?
Yes. Yes, he made his own scent. I remember seeing him cut up, he always hated cats. And in the fall of the year, he would find a cat somewhere and kill it and just skin that cat and cut that. Well, he would do it before the fall of the year because it had to age some. And I remember him telling me that he caught a female fox in a trap one time, and this female fox was in heat, and he took her ovaries or whatever it was, her reproductive system, and made scent out of that. And he had that in a bottle, and he had it with him. And the first night that he set the traps for that, he got a tremendous amount of male foxes. But somewhere on his route, he lost that bottle. And he never caught another one that way that he could use. And I remember him telling, going across the Route 100 and up into Studson Hollow, and there was a family lived in Studson Hollow by the name of Paul Tierney, and Dennis used to stop and chat with him once in a while, and he was another one of these people that lived way back in the woods and had a big family and no cows to ship milk from. And I don't think he ever went down and worked in the mills, perhaps. I never heard that he did. Of course, there were mills going, and you might earn a dollar and a quarter a day or something like that. But, you know, that wouldn't go. But some of them, you know, there was only so many mills and so many chances for people. And if you weren't a mill worker, you tried to get a living some other way. And so Dennis saw it had come a little snow, 2-3 inches of snow, and when he was going to his traps up there in Sutton Hollow, he saw where this man had been out with a horse and a stone boat, and the stone boat came down on that snow, you know, and there was blood running off from the stone boat into that snow along, and so he tracked it along down to Paul Tierney's house, and he said he knew Paul real well, and he says, I see you was lucky last night. And Paul said, yes, I got a nice buck last night. And he said, Dennis says, aren't you kind of nervous about the game warden doing this right on snow like this? He says, no, I don't, I'm not nervous about the game warden at all. I told them that they could take me and fine me if they wanted to take me to court about it and fine me, but I didn't have any money to pay the fine, so then they would put me in jail. But if they put me in jail, they would have to take care of my family. So he says they don't bother me, they don't come near me, and whenever we need some more meat, I go out and get another deer. And that's the way a lot of people lived. It was not only hard going for people, but they had to work awfully hard. Dennis, my older brother, went to work for a man named Roy Heath, which is on the back side of the square now where Lester Senart owns over in back. And it seems that Roy Heath was a very energetic fellow, and he tapped two sugar places. He and his half-brother owned two adjoining farms, and I took it by what Denny said, that he had the sugar places on both of them. And all this sap was coming into one sugar house, and he had two boiling rigs in that one sugar house. Each one was 4 foot wide by 12 foot long. And his half-brother, Clifford Heath, and Clifford's stepfather, Ken Brooks, was doing the boiling, one running each one of those rigs, you see. And Henry Brooks, of course, was a close relative of theirs. I'm not sure just how much, but or where how it was. But Henry Brooks ran the mill, a lumber mill in Warren Village for years and years, and he used to take, when Roy would get in trouble and get a lot of sap, he would just call up Henry, and he would take some of those men from the mill and go up there, and they would gather sap all day, and they had two teams going, and all of a sudden, Roy, Clifford Heath, and Ken Brooks both came down with the grip or flu or whatever it was, and they were sick of bed. And here all this sap was in the woods, something like 3,000 buckets, and nobody together to boil the sap. And Dennis had been helping gather, and Dennis and Roy was a very nervous man, and he said, I don't know what I'm going to do. Dennis says, I know what we're going to do. I'm going to get up at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning, and I'm going up to that sugar house and stack those rigs up. And he says, did you ever boil? Dennis says, yes, I boiled with one rig for my father some. And Roy says, well, you can't do it, and I wish you wouldn't try. We'll just let the sap run on the ground. But anyway, then he got up the next morning and started those two rigs, and he ran those two rigs all day long and took care of the sap from two teams and four men gathering. And those were the kind of men that you were talking about, that if need be, they could do three or four men's work. They were so strong and just amazing, you know. It's just really amazing what they could do.
Now, how much older was Denny than you?
He was 17 years older than I was.
And it was his son that was almost a brother to you?
No, it was my sister Ethel's older son that was, and his nephew, Ward's, no, grand, his grandson, came to work for Marion and I, and he helped us hay 3 different years when he was in high school, and he helped us sugar 2 years, and he has got that same kind of a desire in him to work with nature. And he it makes his father pretty disgusted, because he's a good carpenter. Mike is a good carpenter, and he works summers and for part of the winters. But when sugaring comes, there's no more of that kind of work for him. He tapped 700 buckets this year down in Alston, New Hampshire, and I let him take my team, my best team, to go down in my gathering tank and my sled. I furnished him, and I gave him Marion and I gave him $1,200 to pay towards his new evaporator last year. He had been sugaring on a small scale before that, and so this year, and he was just up here yesterday, and he called me ahead of time, wanted to know if he could borrow my truck. He had a chance to have some hen manure given to him to fertilize this farm where he's doing the sugaring, and he wants to cut hay and to have hay for my, and he and his cousin are sort of in together, and they have some horses, and he just very energetic fellow.
How did he do with the sugaring this year?
How did he?
Yeah.
He made 110 gallons, he said. But in the southern part of the state, he said that the weather was terrible for sugaring. I guess it was better up in the central part of Vermont than it was down there. Well, another thing that I thought of telling about this morning was the difference, the terrible difference there is in education now in the schools. Of course, when I was, I started high school in 1929 in the fall and graduated in 34, and I went to school in that little schoolhouse in Waitsfield. There's a sign up there now. But since then, Waterbury and Waitsfield have combined, or the Valley has combined with Waterbury, and built the new high school, Howard Union High School. And those children now, I talk with them and their parents, and you find out that they have these teachers that teach music, and they teach just about everything that anyone could possibly want. I know some of these gifted children have gone to the state musical things and taken part, and you see, we didn't have any such chance as that when I went. I would have loved to have taken up some music, but there was no chance. And the school was small, but it was like a family at that time. The teachers and the children was like a big family. and you went to your teachers for advice on different things that had nothing to do with school, you know, and they would give you the best advice that they could. And I believe there was 14 in my graduating class, which, and we started out, of course, with lots more than that, but some dropped out, probably started out with around 20. And it's different in the sense that the things that they put up with nowadays in school. For instance, nowadays, if a girl gets pregnant, she goes along and she finishes her year if she can and gets a lot of cooperation like that, you know. But I remember there was one girl in my class in high school that got pregnant and so forth. And the school directors, of course, met with my principal, and it was his job to take that girl's diploma over to her and ask her not to appear with the rest of the class for graduation. And that's the way they did things in those days. If your character wasn't pretty good, you just got ousted, kicked out. Think of anything more, Marion, about school? My principal was an extraordinary man, I thought. He was very good to, if he liked you, if you were a hellraiser in the sense that you destroyed property and things like that, or if you didn't come to school to try to learn something, he didn't want much to do with you. He didn't want, if your marks were down a little bit or something, you didn't play baseball. You just, if he liked you and your marks were down a little, that made a little difference. He could put up with some things, you know, if you were trying, but some of them weren't trying. And he was a very nice man.
I remember you told me, and we didn't get it on tape, the story of the girl you went over to see who, I think, hit you, was it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We didn't get that on tape.
We didn't get that on tape.
I was raised up there in East Warren by Blueberry Lake, and my parents didn't have any automobile. So that when I went to high school, I lived with three other boys that a lady called Mrs. Lamorder, and we rented rooms there for $1 a week and then boarded ourselves. Our parents furnished our food, and that's the way we were able to go to high school because we were so far, and they didn't have buses. And the Waitsfield High School had one bus that they transported the grade children. You couldn't get a ride on that bus if you were a high school student. They drove right by you because they didn't have room for it, and they didn't have money enough to do. Well, this was sort of peculiar. I don't know why, but Ray Pessel always liked me, and I did some pretty foolish things. Like I say, I grew up back there, and there was no chance to get rid of all of this energy that I had, except in work. I got all kinds of work to do, but I never had a chance to have much fun until I went to high school and went in with those four boys, and then I don't know, it just seems as if that I had so much energy and so much deviltry in me that I couldn't contain it. And there was this French girl that I liked pretty well, and I used to dance with her some at the dances, and Ed Irish and I had a date with her and her sister one night to walk them from Carl Long's store up to their turn. Of course, their father and mother wouldn't allow any boys to come over there to see their daughters, and we were going to walk them up there. But this Tim Goodyear had his father's car, and he and Elwin Neal, which was one of the boys that that lived there, Mrs. LaMorta's with us. They came along to Carl Long's store, and seems that they had seen the girls when they went in. And Ed and I arrived there at the store, and Tim's car was sitting in front of the store. And those girls came out of the store, and they didn't pay any attention to Ed and I. They got a chance to go for a ride with Elwin and Tim. So in the car, they got up. And back in those days, the cars were built straight up and down on the back end, and there was a little bumperette on each corner. And then in the center, there was this spare wheel. And we jumped on, each one of us jumped on one of those bumperettes and took hold of that spare tire. And they found out that we were on there. And when Tim went across Irisville Flat up there, he told us later that he was doing 60 miles an hour. And I never was so scared in my life as I was, because, you know, there was not much to hang to. And when they slowed down for the Dugway, which is at the other end of Irisville, we left that thing. And we went on our hands and knees and stomachs and chests and everything else in the middle of the road. And, of course, in those days when I would get ready to go, I was anywhere, I was always in a hurry, and I lots of times didn't tie up my shoes. Well, the first two steps that I took after I left that thing, those shoes went way over in the bushes. talk about a horse throwing their shoes. I threw mine, but they weren't nailed on, really. Well, anyway, I had danced a lot with this girl, this French girl, and I got the urge to move around and stop studying, so I went down my stairway on the north side of the schoolhouse and came back up the south side. There was two stairways, one on each side, and she was